Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. Tonight is our reading night, although we read every night. This is more of a spiritual program. Tonight I wanted to read. I don't know if I'll get through it all tonight, but I'll try. Wealth is an essay that was written by Ralph Waldo Emerson in a series, The Conduct of Life, which is a series of essays that he wrote. And, of course, he wrote these almost 200 years ago, and 150 years ago or so. So even though I believe the language is very clear, sometimes there's changes, you know, that have been made over grammar and so on in over the last several hundred years, of course. So, but I believe these are rather true to form. This is from the entire works, complete works of Emerson. So it's quite an amazing book. I think it's about 700. It's sectioned up into like four different books, so four volumes. But anyway, this one's called The Conduct of Life, and the essay is called Wealth. As soon as a stranger is introduced into any company, one of the first questions which I'll wish to have answered is, how does that man get his living? And with reason, he is no whole man until he knows how to earn a blameless livelihood. Society is barbarous until every industrious man can get his living without dishonest customs. Every man is a consumer, not to be a producer. He fails to make his place good in the world unless he does not only pay his debts, but also add something to the commonwealth. Nor can he do justice to his genius without making some larger demand on the world than a bare subsistence. He is by constitution expensive and needs to be rich. Wealth has its source in applications of the mind and to nature, from the rudest strokes of spade and axe up into the latest, onto the last secrets of art. Intimate ties subsist between thought and all production, because a better order is equivalent to vast amounts of brute labor. The forces and resistances are nature's, but the mind acts in bringing things from where they bound to where they are wanted. In wise combining, in directing the practice of the useful arts, and in the creation of finer values, by fine art, by eloquence, by song, or the reproductions of memory. Wealth is in applications of mind to nature, and the art of getting rich consists not in industry, much less in savings, but in a better order, in timelessness, in being at the right spot. One man has strong arms or longer legs, another sees by the course of streams and growth of markets where land will be wanted, makes a clearing to the river, goes to sleep and wakes up rich. Steam is no stronger now than it was 100 years ago, but it's put to better use. A clever fellow was acquainted with the expansive force of steam. He also saw the wealth of wheat and grass rotting in Michigan. Then he cunningly screws on the steam pipe to the wheat crop, and puff now with steam. The steam puffs and expands as before, but this time it's dragging all Michigan at its back to hungry New York and hungry England. Coal lays in ledges under the ground since the flood, until a laborer with pick and windlass brings it to the surface. He may well call it black diamonds. Every basket is power and civilization, for coal is a portable climate. It carries the heat of the tropics to Labrador and the polar circle, and it is the means of transporting itself whithersoever it is wanted. Watt and Stevenson whispered in the car of mankind their secret that a half ounce of coal will draw 2 tons a mile, and coal carries coal by rail and by boat to make Canada as warm as Calcutta, and with its comfort brings its industrial power. When the farmer's peaches are taken from under the tree and carried into town, they have a new look and a hundredfold value over the fruit that grew on the same bough and lies fulsomely on the ground. The craft of the merchant is the bringing a thing from where it abounds to where it is costly. Wealth begins in a tight roof that keeps the rain and wind out, and a good pump that yields you plenty of street water. In two suits of clothes, so to change your dress when you are wet. In dry sticks to burn, in a good double wick lamp, three meals and a horse or a locomotive to cross the land, and a boat to cross the sea, and tools to work with, and a book to read, and so in giving on all sides by tools and auxiliaries the greatest possible extension to our powers, as if it added feet and hands and eyes and blood, length to the day and knowledge and goodwill. Wealth begins with these articles of necessity, and here we must recite the iron law which nature thunders in these northern climates. First, she requires that each man should feed himself. If happily his fathers have left him no inheritance, he must go to work and be making his want less and his gains more. He must draw himself out of that state of pain and insult in which she forces the beggar to lie. And she gives him no rest until it is done. She starves, taunts, and torments him, takes away warmth, laughter, sleep, friends, and daylight until he has fought his way to his own loaf. Then, less peremptorily, but still with sting enough, she urges him to the acquisition of such things as belong to him. And every warehouse and shop window, every fruit tree, every thought of every hour opens a new want to him, which it concerns his power and dignity to gratify. It is of no use to argue the wants down. The philosophers have laid the greatness of man in making his wants few. But will a man content himself with a hut and a handful of dried peas? He is born to be rich. He is thoroughly related and is tempted out of his appetites and fancies to the conquest of this and that piece of nature until he finds his well-being in the use of his planet and of more planets than this his own. Wealth requires, besides the crust of bread and the roof, the freedom of the city, the freedom of the earth, the traveling machinery, the benefits of science, music, and fine arts, the best culture, and the best company. He is the rich man who can avail himself of all men's faculties. He is the richest man who knows how to draw a benefit from the labors of the greatest number of men in distant countries and in past times. The same correspondence that is between thirst in the stomach and water in the spring exists between the whole of man and the whole of nature. The elements offer their service to him. The sea, washing the equator and the poles, offers its perilous aid and the power and empire that follow it, day by day, day to his craft and audacity. Beware of me, it says, but if you can hold me, I am the key to all the lands. Fire offers on its side an equal power. Fire, steam, lightning, gravity, ledges of rock, mines of iron, lead, quicksilver, tin, and gold, forests of all woods, fruits of all climates, animals of all habitats, the power of tillage, the fabrics of the chemic laboratory, the webs of his loom, masculine draught of his locomotive, the talismans of the machine shop, all grand and subtle things, minerals, gases, ethers, passion, war, trade, government, are his natural playmates. And according to the excellence of the machinery in each human being, is his attraction for the instruments he is to employ. The world is his tool chest, and he is successful, or his education is carried on just so far, as is the marriage of his faculties with nature, or the degree in which he takes up things unto himself. strong race is strong in these terms. The Saxons are the merchants of the world, now for 1,000 years the leading race, and by nothing more than their quality of personal independence, and in its special modification, pecuniary independence. No reliance for bread and games on the government, no clansship, no patriarchal style of living by the revenues of a chief, no marrying on, no system of clientship suits them. But every man must pay his scot. The English are prosperous and peaceful with their habit of considering that every man must take care of himself and has himself to thank if he do not maintain and improve his position in society. The subject of economy mixes itself with morals, inasmuch as it is a preemptory point of virtue that a man's independence be secured. Poverty demoralizes. A man in debt is so far a slave, and Wall Street thinks it easy for a millionaire to be a man of his word, a man of honor, but that in failing circumstances no man can be relied on to keep his integrity. And when one observes in the hotels and palaces of our Atlantic capitals the habit of expense, the riot of the senses, the absence of bonds, clanship, fellow feeling of any kind, he feels that when a man or a woman is driven to the wall, the chances of integrity are frighteningly diminished, as if virtue were coming to be a luxury that few could afford, or as Burke said, at a market almost too high for humanity. He may fix his inventory of necessities and of enjoyments on what scale he pleases, but if he wishes the power and privilege of thought, the chalking out his own career, and having society on his own terms, he must bring his wants within his power, proper power to satisfy. The manly part is to do with might and main what you can do. The world is full of fops who never did anything, and who have persuaded beauties and men of genius to wear their fop livery, and these will deliver the fop opinion that it is not respectable to be seen earning a living, that it is much more respectable to spend without earning. And this the doctrine of the snake will come also from the elect sons of light, for wise men are not wise at all hours, and will speak 5 times from their taste or their humor to once from their reason. And the brave workman, who might betray his feelings of it in his manners, if he do not succumb to his practice, must replace the grace or elegance forfeited by the merit of the work done. No matter whether he makes shoes or statues or laws, it is the privilege of any human work which is well done to invest the doer into a certain haughtiness. He can well afford not to conciliate whose faithful work will answer for him. The mechanic at his bench carries a quiet heart and assured manners, and deals on even terms with men of any condition. The artist has made his picture so true that it disconcerts criticism. The statue is so beautiful that it contracts no stain from the market, but makes the market a slight silent gallery for itself. The case of the young lawyer was pitiful to discuss. A paltry matter of buttons or tweezer cases, but the determined youth saw in it an aperture to insert his dangerous wedges, made this insignificance of the thing forgotten, and gave fame by his sense and energy to this name in affair of the Tittleton snuffbox factory. Society in large towns is babyish, and wealth is made a toy. The life of pleasure is so ostentatious that a shallow observer must believe that this is the agreed use of wealth, and whatever is pretended, it ends in cossetting. But if this were the main use of surplus capital, it would bring us to barricades, burned towns, and tomahawks presently. Men of sense esteem wealth to be the assimilation of nature to themselves, the converting of the sap and juices of the planet to the incarnation and nurturement of their design. is what they want, not candy. Power to execute their design, power to give legs and feet form and actuality to their thought, which to a clear-sighted man appears the end for which the universe exists and all its resources might well be applied. Columbus thinks that the sphere is a problem for the practical navigation as well as for closet geometry, and looks on all kings and people as cowardly landsmen until they dare fit him out. Few men on the planet have more truly belonged to it, but he was forced to leave much of his map blank. His successors inherited his map and inherited his fury to complete it. So the men of the mine, telegraph, mill, map, and survey, the monomaniacs who talk up their projects and marts and offices and entreat people to subscribe, how did our factories get built? How did North America get netted with iron rails except by the importunity of these orators who dragged all of the prudent men in? In party, the madness of many of the gain for the gain of a few. This speculative genius is the madness of a few for the gain of the world. And the projectors are sacrificed. But the public is the gainer. Each of these idealists working after his thought would make it tyrannical if he could. He is met and antagonized by other speculators, as hot as he. The equilibrium is preserved by these counteractions, as one tree keeps down another in the forest. That is, that it may not absorb all the sap in the ground. And the supply and nature of the railroad presidents, copper miners, grand junctioners, smoke burners, fire inhalers, and etc. is limited by the same law, which keeps the proportion of the supply of carbon or aluminum and of hydrogen. To be rich is to have a ticket of admission to the masterworks and chief men of each race. It is to have the sea by voyaging, to visit the mountains, Niagara, the Nile, the desert, Rome, Paris, Constantinople, to see galleries, libraries, arsenals, manufactories. The reader of Humboldt's Cosmos follows the marches of a man whose eyes, ears, and mind are armed by all the science, arts, and implements which mankind have anywhere accumulated, and who is using these to add to the stock. So is it with Dinan, Backford, Belzoni, Wilkinson, Layard, Kane, Lepsius, and Livingston. The rich man, says Saadi, is everywhere expected and at home. The rich take up something more of the world into man's life. They include the country as well as the town, the oceanside, the white hills, the far west, the old European homestead of man in their notion of available material. The world is his who has money to go over it. He arrives at the seashore in a sumptuous ship as floored and carpeted for him in the stormy Atlantic and made it a luxurious hotel amid the horrors of the tempests. The Persians say, 'Tis the same to him who wears a shoe as him the whole earth were covered with leather. Interesting. It's the same to him who wears a shoe as if the whole earth were covered with leather. Like that. Kings are said to have long arms, but every man should have long arms and should pluck his living, his instruments, his power, and his knowing from the sun, moon, and stars. Is not then the demand to be rich legitimate? Yes, I have never seen a rich man. Yet I have never seen a rich man. I have never seen a man as rich as all men ought to be, or with an adequate command of nature. The pulpit and the press have many commonplaces denouncing the threat, the thirst for wealth. But if man should take these moralists at their word and leave off aiming to be rich, the moralists would rush to rekindle at all hazards this love of power in the people, lest civilization should be undone. And men are urged by their ideas to acquire the command over nature. Ages derive a culture from the wealth of Roman Caesars, Leo X's, magnificent kings of France, Grand Dukes of Tuscany and Dukes of Devonshire, Townleys, Vernons, and Peels in England, or whatever great proprietors. It is the interest of all men that there should be Vaticans and Louvres full of noble works of art, British museums and French gardens of plants, Philadelphia academies of natural history, Bodleian, Ambrosian, Royal, and Congressional libraries. It is the interest of all that there should be exploring expeditions, Captain Cook's The Voyage Round the World, and Rossi's, Franklin's, Richardson's, and Kane's to find the magnetic and geographic poles. We are all richer for the measurement of a degree of latitude in the Earth's surface. Our navigation is safer for the chart. How intimately our knowledge of the system of the universe rests on that. And a true economy in the state of an individual will forget its frugality in behalf of claims like these. For those who may have just joined us, I'm reading the essay Wealth from The Conduct of Life by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And it is each man's interest that not only ease and convenience and convenience of living, but also wealth or a surplus product should exist somewhere. It need not be in the hands. Often it is very undesirable to him. Goethe said, well, nobody should be rich but those who understand it. And some men are born to own and can animate all their possessions. Others cannot. Their owning is not graceful. It seems to be a compromise of their character. They seem to steal their own dividends. They should own who can administer, not they who hoard and conceal, not they who the great proprietors they are only the greater beggars, but they whose work carves out work for more, opens a path for all. For he is the rich man in whom the people are rich, and he is the poor man in whom the people are poor. And how to give all access to the masterpieces of arts and nature is the problem of civilization. The socialism of our day has done good service in setting men on thinking how certain civilizing benefits, not only enjoyed by the opulent, can be enjoyed by all. For example, the providing to each man the means and apparatus of science and of the arts. There are many articles good for occasional use, and few men are able to own. Every man wishes to see the ring of Saturn, the satellites and belts of Jupiter and Mars, the mountains and craters in the moon, yet how few can buy a telescope, and of those scarcely one would like the troubling, a few would like the trouble of keeping it in order and exhibiting it. So of electrical and chemical apparatus and many of the things like every man may have occasion to consult books which he does not care to possess, such as encyclopedias, dictionaries, tables, charts, maps, public documents, pictures also of birds, beasts, fish, shells, trees, flowers, whose names he desires to know. There is a refining influence from the art of design on the prepared mind, which is as positive as that of music, and not to be supplied from any other source. But pictures, engravings, statues, and casts, beside their first cost, entail expenses as of galleries and keepers for the exhibition, and the use which any man can make of them is rare, and their value, too, is much enhanced by the number of men who can share their enjoyment. In the Greek cities, it was reckoned profane that any person should pretend a property in a work of art which belonged to all who could behold it. I think sometimes, could I only have music on my own terms, could I live in a great city and know where I could go whenever I wished the ablution and inundation of musical waves that were a bath and a medicine. If properties of this kind were owned by states, towns, and lyceums, they would draw the bonds of neighborhood closer. A town could exist for an intellectual purpose. The Europe, where where the feudal forms secure the permanence of wealth in certain families, those families buy and preserve these things and lay them open to the public. But in America, where democratic institutions divide every estate into small portions, after a few years, the public would step into the place of these proprietors and provide this culture and inspiration for the citizen. Man was born to be rich, or inevitably grows rich by the use of his faculties, by the union of thought with nature. Property is an intellectual production. The game requires coolness, right reasoning, promptness, and patience in the player. Cultivated labor drives out brute labor. An infinite number of shrewd men in infinite years have arrived at certain best and shortest ways of doing, and this accumulated skill in arts, culture, harvesting, curing, manufacturing, manufactures, navigations, exchanges, constitutes the worth of our world today. Commerce is a game of skill, which every man cannot play, which few men can well play, or can play well. The right merchant is one who has the just average of faculties that we call common sense. A man of a strong affinity for facts who makes up his decision on what he has seen. He is thoroughly persuaded of the truths of arithmetic. There is always a reason in the man for his good or bad fortune, and so in making money. Men talk as if there were some magic about this, and believing in magic in all parts of life. He knows that all goes on the old road, pound for pound, cent for cent, for every effect a perfect cause, and that good luck is another name for tenacity of purpose. He insures himself in every transaction and likes small and sure gains. Probity and closeness to the facts are the basis, but the masters of the art add a certain long arithmetic. The problem is to combine many and remote operations with the accuracy and adherence to the facts, which is easy and near in small transactions, so to arrive at gigantic results without any compromise or safety. Napoleon was fond of telling the story of the Marseilles banker who said to his visitor, surprised at the contrast between the splendor of the banker's chateau and hospitality and the meanness of the counting room in which he had seen him, "Young man, you are too young to understand how masses are formed. The true and only power, whether composed of money, water, or men, it is all alike. A mass is an immense center of motion, but it must be begun. It must be kept up, and he must have added that the way in which it must be begun and kept up is by obedience to the law of particles. Success consists of close appliance to the law of the world, and which those laws are intellectual and moral, and intellectual and moral obedience. Political economy is as good a book wherein to read the life of man and the ascendancy of laws over all private and hostile influences as any Bible which has come down to us. Money is representative and follows the nature and fondness of the owner. The coin is a delicate meter of civil, social, and moral changes. The farmer is covetous of his dollar, and with reason. It is no waif to him. He knows how many strokes of labor it represents. His body aches with the day's work that earns it. He knows how much land it represents, how much rain, and frost, and sunshine. He knows that in the dollar he gives you so much discretion and patience, so much honing and threshing. Try to lift this dollar, and you must lift all that weight. In a city where money follows the skit of a pen, or a lucky rise in exchange, comes to be looked on as light. I wish the farmer held it dearer and would spend it only for real bread, force for force. The farmer's dollar is heavy and the clerk's is light and nimble. Leaps out of his pocket, jumps onto the cards and faro tables, But still, more curious is its susceptibility to metaphysical changes. It is the finest barometer of social storms and announces revolutions. Every step of civil advancement makes every man's dollar worth more. In California, the country where it grew, it would be a buy. What would it buy, rather? A few years since, it would buy a shanty, dysentery, hunger, bad company, and crime. There are wide countries like Siberia where it would buy little else today than some pretty petty mitigation of suffering. In Rome, it will buy beauty and magnificence. 40 years ago, a dollar could not buy much in Boston. Now it will buy a great deal more in our old town, thanks to railroads, telegraphs, steamers, and contemporaneous growth of New York and the whole country. Yet there are many goods appertaining to a capital city which are not yet purchasable here. No, not with a mountain of dollars. A dollar in Florida is not worth a dollar in Massachusetts. A dollar is not value, but representative of value, and at last of moral values. A dollar is rated for the corn it will buy, or to speak strictly, not for the corn or house room, but for Anthonium corn and Roman house room. For the wit, probity, and power, which we eat bread and dwell in houses to share and exert, wealth is mental, wealth is moral. The value of a dollar is to buy just things. A dollar goes on increasing in value with all the genius and all the virtue of the world. A dollar is a university. In a university is worth more than a dollar in a jail, in a temperate schooled law-abiding community than in some sink of crime, where dice, knives, and arsenic are in constant play. The banknote director is a useful publication, but the current dollar, silver or paper, is itself the detector of the right and wrong. If a trader refuses to sell his vote or adheres to some odious right, he makes so much more equity in Massachusetts, and every acre in the state is worth more in the hour of his action. If you take out of the street of the state street the 10 honest honestest, he's got there. I don't know if that's a word. But take the most honest merchants and put in 10 roguish persons controlling the same amount of capital, the rate of insurance will indicate it. The soundness of a bank will show it. The highways will be less secure. The schools will feel it. The children will bring home their little dose of the poison. And the judge will sit less firmly on the bench, and his decision be less upright. He has lost so much support and constraint, which all need, and the pulpit will betray it in a laxer rule of life. An apple tree, if you take out every day for a number of days a load of loam and put in a loam of sand about its roots, we'll find it out. An apple tree is a stupid kind of creature, but if this treatment be pursued for a short time, I think it would begin to mistrust something. And if you should take out of the powerful class engaged in trade 100 good men and put in 100 bad, or what is just the same thing, introducing a demoralizing institution, would not the dollar, which is not much stupider than an apple tree, presently find it out? The value of a dollar is social, as it is created by society. Every man who removes into the city with his purchasable talent or skill in him gives to every man's labor in the city a new worth. If a talent is anywhere born into the world, the community of nations is enriched, and much more with a new degree of probity. The expense of crime one of the principal charges of every nation, is so far stopped. In Europe, crime is observed to increase or abate with the price of bread. Now, again, I have to note that this was written 150 years or more ago. Okay, so it's important in the 18. This was in the 1850s or so. So it's important to note that the similarities to the American economy today, but also note the differences in the towns that he talks about and the different things that are going on. But it's odd that it's very similar to what we're undergoing today, same problems. And that's the universality of Emerson's work. If the Rothschilds of Paris did not accept bills, the people at Manchester and Paley at Birmingham are forced into the highway, and landlords are shot down in Ireland. The police record attests it. The vibrations are presently felt in New York, New Orleans, and Chicago. Not much otherwise. The economical power touches the masses through the political lords. Rothschild refused the Russian loan, and there is peace, and their harvests are saved. He takes it, and there is war, and an agitation through a large portion of mankind, with every hideous result, ending in revolution and a new order. Wealth brings with it its own checks and balances. The basis of political economy is non-interference. The only safe rule is found in a self-adjusting meter of demand and supply. Do not legislate metal and you snap the sinews with your sumptuary laws. Give no bounties. Make equal laws. Secure life and property, and you need not give alms. Open the door of opportunity to talent and virtue, and they will do themselves justice, and property will not be in the bad hands. In a free and just commonwealth, property rushes from the idle and imbecile to the industrious, brave, and persevering. The laws of nature play through trade as a toy battery exhibits the effects of electricity. The level of the sea is not more surely kept than is the equilibrium of value in society. By the demand and supply, an artifice or legislation punishes itself by reactions, gluts, and bankruptcies. The sublime laws are playing indifferently through axioms and galaxies. Whoever knows whoever knows what happens in the getting and spending of a loaf of bread and a pint of beer, that no wishing will change the rigorous limits of pints and penny loaves, that for all that is consumed, so much less remains in the basket and pot. But what is gone out of these is not wasted, but well spent. If it nourish his body and enable him to finish his task, knows all of the political economy that the budget of empires can teach him. The interest of petty economy is the symbolism of the great economy, the way in which a house and a private man's methods tally with the solar system, and the laws of give and take throughout nature. And however wary we are of the falsehoods and petty tricks which we suicidally play off on each other, every man has a certain satisfaction whenever his dealing touches on the inevitable facts, when he sees that things themselves dictate the price, as they always tend to do, and in large manufactures are seen to do. Your paper is not fine or coarse enough. It is too heavy or too thin. The manufacturer says, we will furnish you with just that thickness or thinness you want. And the pattern is quite indifferent to him. Here is his schedule. Any variety of paper is cheaper or dearer, with the price annexed. A pound of paper costs so much, and you may have it made up in any pattern you fancy. There is in all our dealings a self-regulation that supersedes chaffering. You will rent a house, but must have it cheap. The owner can reduce the rent, but so he incapacitates himself for making proper repairs, and the tenant gets not the house he would have, but a worse one. Besides that a relation a little injurious is established between landlord and tenant, you dismiss your labor, saying, Patrick, I shall send you as soon as I cannot do without you. I will send for you as soon as I cannot do without you. Patrick goes off contented, for he knows that the weeds will grow with the potatoes, and the vine must be planted next week. And however unwilling you may be, the cantaloupes, crooknecks, and cucumbers will send for him. And who but must wish that all labor and value should stand on the same simple and surly market? If it is the best of its kind, it will. We must have joiner, locksmith, planter, priest, poet, doctor, cook, reaver, ostler, each in turn through the year. If a St. Michael's pear sells for a shilling, it costs a shilling to raise it. If in Boston, the best securities offer 12% for money, they have just 6% of insecurity. You may not see that the fine pear costs you a shilling, but it costs the community so much. A shilling represents the number of enemies the pear has, and the amount of risk is ripening it. The price of coal shows the narrowness of the coal field and the compulsory confinement of the miners to a certain district. All salaries are reckoned on contingent, and as well as on actual services. If the wind were always southwest by west, said the skipper, women might take ships to sea. One might say that all things are of one price, that nothing is cheap or dear, and that the apparent disparities that strike us are only a shopman's trick of concealing the damage in your bargain. A youth coming into the city from his native New Hampshire farm and his hard fare still fresh in his remembrance, boards at a first-class hotel and believes that he must somehow have outwitted Dr. Franklin and Malthus, for luxuries are cheap. But he pays for the one convenience of a better dinner by the loss of some of the richest social and educational advantages. He has lost what guards, what incentives. He will perhaps by and by that he left the muses at the door of the hotel and found the Furies inside. Money often costs too much, and power and pleasure are not cheap. The ancient poet said, the gods sell all things at a fair price. There is an example of the compensations in the commercial history of this country. When the European wars threw the carrying trade of the world from 1800 to 1812 into American bottoms, a seizure was now and then made of an American ship. Of course, the loss was serious to the owner, but the country was indemnified, for we charged 3 pence a pound for carrying cotton, 6 pence for tobacco, and so on, and which paid for the risk and loss, and brought into the account an immense prosperity, early marriages, private wealth, the building of cities and states, and after the war was over, we received compensation over and over by treaty for all the seizures. Well, the Americans grew rich and great, but the payday comes round. Britain, France, and Germany, which our extraordinary profits had impoverished, sent out, attracted by the fame of our advantages, first their thousands, then their millions of poor people to share the crop. At first we employ them and increase our prosperity, but in the artificial system of society and of protected labor, which we also have adopted and enlarged, there comes presently checks and stoppages. Then we refuse to employ these poor men, but they will not so be answered. They go into the poor rates, and though we refuse wages, we must now pay the same amount in the form of taxes again. It turns out that the largest portion of the crimes are committed by foreigners. The cost of the crime and the expense of courts and of prisons we must bear, and the standing army of preventative police we must pay. And the cost of education and the prosperity of this great colony I will not compute, but the gross amount of these costs will begin to pay back what we thought was a net gain from our transatlantic customers of 1800. It is vain to refuse this payment. We cannot get rid of these people, and we cannot get rid of their will to be supported. That has become an inevitable element of our politics, and for that vote, and for their votes, each of the dominant parties courts and assists them to get it executed. Moreover, we have to pay not what would have contented them at home, but what they have learned to think necessary here. So that opinion, fancy, and all manner of moral consideration complicates the problem. He's talking about now, today. I mean, he's talking 200 years ago, what we are going through right now. The same thing, the same problem with illegal immigration. And, you know, at that point, it wasn't really illegal, but they had to put a curb on it because they were having the same problems we're having today. I kind of lost my space here. Our nature and genius force us to respect ends whilst we use means. We must use the means, and yet in our most accurate using somehow screen and cloak them, as we can only give them any beauty by a reflection of the glory of the end. That is the good head which serves the end and commands the means. The rabble are corrupted by their means. The means are too strong for them, and they desert their end. First, the first of these measures is that each man's expenses must proceed from his character. As long as your genius buys, the investment is safe, though you spend like a monarch. Nature arms each man with some faculty, which enables him to do easily some feat impossible to any other, and thus makes him necessary to society. This native determination guides his labor and his spending. He wants an equipment of means and tools proper to his talent, and to save on this point, where to neutralize the special strength and helpfulness of each mind, do your work, respecting the excellence of the work, and do it acceptableness, and not its acceptableness. This is so much economy that, rightly read, it is the sum of economy. Profligacy, a new word for me, profligacy consists not in spending years of time or chests of money, but in spending them off the line of your career. The crime which bankrupts men and states is job work, declining from your main design to serve a turn here or there. Nothing is beneath you if it is in the direction of your life. Nothing is great or desirable if it is off from that. I think that we are entitled here to draw a straight line and say that society can never prosper, but must always be bankrupt until every man does that which he was created to do. Spend for your expense and retrench the expense which is not yours. Alliston, the painter, was wont to say that he built a plain house and filled it with plain furniture because he would hold out no bribe to any to visit him who had not a similar taste to his own. We are sympathetic and, like children, want everything we see. But it is a large stride to independence when a man, in the discovery of his proper talent, has sunk the necessity for false expenses. As the betrothed maiden, by one secure affection, is relieved from a system of slaveries, the daily inculcated necessity of pleasing all, so that the man who has found what he can do can spend on that and leave all other spending. Montaigne said, when he was a younger brother, he went brave in dress and equipage, but afterward his chateau and farms might answer for him. Let a man who belongs to the class of nobles, those namely who have found out that they can do something, relieve himself of all vague squanderings on objects not his. Let the realist not mind appearances. Let him delegate to others the costly courtesies and decorations of social life. The virtues are economists, but some of the vices are also. Thus, next to humility, I have noticed that pride is a pretty good husband, A good pride is, as I reckon it, worth from $500 to $1,500 a year. Pride is handsome. Economical pride eradicates so many vices, letting none subsist but itself, that it seems as if it were a great pain to exchange vanity for pride. Pride can go without domestics, without fine clothes, can live in a house with two rooms, can eat potato, porcelain, beans, lied corn, and can work on the soil, can travel afoot, can talk with poor men, or sit still, well-conditioned, contented in fine saloons. But vanity costs money, and labor, horses, men, women, health, and peace, and is still nothing at last, a long way leading nowhere. Only one drawback. Proud people are intolerably selfish, and the vain are gentle and giving. Proud people are intolerably selfish, and the vain are gentle and giving. Art is a jealous mistress, and if a man have a genius for painting, poetry, music, architecture, or philosophy, he made a bad husband, makes a bad husband, and an ill provider, and should be wise in season and not fetter himself with duties which will embitter his days and spoil him for his proper work. We had in this region 20 years ago among our educated men a sort of Arcadian fanaticism, a passionate desire to go upon the land and unite farming to intellectual pursuits. And many effected their purpose and made the experiment, and some became downright plowmen. But all were cured of their faith as scholarship and practical farming. I mean, with one's own hand could be united. That's what happened in the hippie movement. You know, very, very similar things that happened for men. Intellectuals decided to take to the earth. And many erected their purpose and made the experiment, and some became downright plowmen. Right? With brow bent and firm intent, the pale scholar leaves the desk to draw a freer breath and get a juster statement of his thought in a garden walk. He stoops to pull up a purslane or a dock that is choking the young corn and finds there are two. Close behind the last is a third. He reaches out his hand to a fourth, and behind that are 4,001. He is heated and untuned, and by and by wakes up from his idiot dream of chickweed and red root to remember his morning thought and to find that with this adamantine purposes, he has been duped by a dandelion. Duped by a dandelion. And a garden is like those pernicious machineries we read of every month in the newspapers, which catch a man's coat skirts or his hand and draw in his arm and leg and his whole body to irresistible destruction. In an evil hour, he pulled down the wall and added a field to his homeland. No land is bad, but land is worse. What that means? No land is bad, but land is worse. If a man owns land, the land owns him. Now let him leave home, if he dare. Every tree and graft, every hill of melons, rows of corn, or quickset hedge, all he has done and all he means to do stand in his way, like duns, when he would go out of his gate. The devotion to these vines and trees he finds poisonous. Long free walks, a circuit of miles, free his brain and serve his body. Long marches are no hardship to him. He believes he composes easily on the hills, but his pottery in a very square yards of garden is dispiriting and dribbling. The smell of the plants has drugged him and robbed him of energy. He finds a catalepsy in his bones. He grows peevish and poor-spirited. The genius of reading and of gardening are antagonistic, like resinous and virtuous electricity. One is concentrative in spark and chokes, or rather in shocks. The other is diffuse strength. so that each disqualifies its workmen for the other's duties. An engraver, whose hands must be of an exquisite delicacy of stroke, should not lay stone walls. Sir Rooster gives exact instructions for microsonic observation. Lie down on your back and hold the single lens and object over your eye. How much more the seeker of abstract truth, who needs periods of isolation and rapt concentration and almost going out of the body to think. 2. Spend your own genius and by system. Nature goes by rule, not by sallies and salutations. This, there must be a system in the economy. Saving and inexpensiveness will not keep the most pathetic family from ruin, nor will bigger incomes make free spending safe. The secret of success lies never in the amount of money, but in the relation of income to outgo. As if after expense has been fixed at a certain point, then new and steady wills of income through, though never so small, being added, wealth begins. But in ordinary, as means increase, spending increases faster. So far, large incomes in England and elsewhere are found not to help matters. The eating quality of debt does not relax its voracity. When the cholera is in the potato, what is the use of planting larger crops? In England, the richest country in the universe, I was assured by shrewd observers that great lords and ladies had no more guineas to give away than other people, that liberality with money is as rare and as immediately famous as virtue as it is here. And want is a growing giant among the coat I have was never large enough to cover. I remember in Warwickshire to have been shown a fair manor, still in the same name as in the Shakespeare time. The rent roll, I was told, is some 14,000 pounds a year. But when the second son of the late proprietor was born, the father had perplexed about how to provide for him. And the eldest son must inherit the manor. What to do with this supernumerary? And he was advised to breed him for the church and to settle him in the rectorship, which was in the gift of the family, which was done. And it is a general rule in that country that bigger incomes do not help anybody. It is commonly observed that a sudden wealth, like a prize drawn in a lottery or a large bequest by a poor family, does not particularly enrich. They have served no apprenticeship to wealth, and with the rapid wealth comes rapid claims, which they do not know how to deny, and the treasure is quickly dissipated. A system must be in every economy, or the best single expedients are of no avail. A farm is a good thing, when it begins and ends with itself and does not need a salary or a shop to eke it out. Thus the cattle are a main link in the chain ring. If the nonconformist or atheistic farmer leaves out the cattle and does not leave out the want which the cattle must supply, he must fill the gap by begging or stealing. And when the men now alive were born, the farm yielded everything that was consumed on it. The farm yielded no money, and the farmer got on without. If he fell sick, his neighbors came in to his aid. Each gave a day's work or a half day or lent his yoke of oxen or his horse, kept his work even, hoed his potatoes, mowed his hay, reaped his rye, well knowing that no man could afford to hire labor without outselling his hand. In autumn, a farmer could sell an ox or a hog and get a little money to pay taxes withal. Now the farmer buys almost all he can consume, tinware, cloths, sugar, tea, coffee, coal, route tickets, and railroad tickets, and newspapers. A master in each art is required, because the practice is never with still or dead subjects, but they change in your hands. You think farm building and broad acres a solid property, but its value is flowing like water. It requires as much watching as if you were decanting wine from a cask. The farmer knows what to do with it, stops every leak, turns all the steamlets on to one reservoir, and decants wine. But a blunderhead comes out of Cornhill, tries his hand, and it all eats away. And that's the end of the show. I just stopped streaming. Those of you who listened, I thank you. And I believe there's still quite a bit left of this. There's only a couple pages more. I believe I'll finish reading that. So it is with granite streets or timber towns and fruit flowers, nor any investment so permanent that it can be allowed to remain without incessant watching, as the history of each attempt to lock up an inheritance through two generations for an unborn inheritor may show. When Mr. Cockane takes a cottage in the country and will keep his cow, he thinks a cow is a creature that is fed on hay and gives a pail of milk twice a day. But the cow that he buys gives milk for 3 months. Then her bag dries up. What to do with the dry cow? Who will buy her? Perhaps he thought also a yoke of oxen to do his work, but they get blown and lame. What to do with blown and lame oxen? The farmer fats his after the spring work is done and kills them in the fall. But how can Cockane, who has no pastures and leaves his cottage daily in the cars at business hours, be bothered with fatting and killing oxen? He plants trees, but there must be crops to keep the trees in plowed land. What shall be the crops? He will have nothing to do with trees, but will have grass. After a year or two, the grass must be turned up and plowed. Now, what crops? Credulous Cockane. 3. Help comes in custom of the country and the rule of impera parendo. The rule is not to dictate, nor to insist on carrying out each of your schemes by ignorant willfulness, but to learn practically the secret spoken from all nature, that things themselves refuse to be mismanaged and will show to the watchful their own law. And nobody needs stir hand or foot. The custom of the country will do it all. I know not how to build or to plant, neither how to buy wood, nor what to do with the house lot, the field, or the wood lot when bought. Never fear. It is all settled how it shall be long beforehand in the custom of the country, whether to sand or to weather to clay it, when to plow or how to dress, whether to grass or to corn, and who cannot help or hinder it. Nature has her own best mode of doing each thing, and she has somewhere told it plainly if we will keep our eyes and ears open. If not, she will not be slow in deceiving and undeceiving us when we prepare our own way to her. How often we must remember the art of the surgeon, which in replacing the broken bone contents itself with releasing the parts from false position. They fly into place by the action of the muscles, and only this art of nature, all of our arts rely. Of the two eminent engineers in the recent construction of the railway in England, Mr. Bruno went straight from terminus to terminus, through mountains, over streams, crossing highways, cutting ducal estates in two, and shooting through this man's cellar and that man's attic window, and so arriving at his end at great pleasure to geometers, but with cost to his company. Mr. Stephenson, on the contrary, believing that the river knows the way, followed his valley as implicitly as our western railroad flows the Westfield River and returns out to be the safest and cheapest engineer. We say that cows laid out Boston. Well, there are worse surveyors. Every pedestrian in our pastures has frequent occasion to thank the cows for cutting the best path through the thickest and over the hills, and travelers and Indians know the value of a buffalo trail, which is sure to be the easiest possible pass through the ridge. When a citizen fresh from Dock Square or Milk Street comes out and buys land in the country, his first thought is to a fine outlook from his window. His library must command a western view, a sunset every day, bathing on the shoulder of Blue Hills. Bathing the shoulder of Blue Hills. Wachusett and the peaks of Monadnock and Ankandunuk, wherever these are. And what 30 acres and all this magnificent for $1,500? It would be cheap at $50,000. He proceeds at once, his eyes dim with tears of joy, to fix the spot for his cornerstone. But the man who is to level the ground thinks it will take many hundred loads of gravel to fill the hollow to the road. The stonemason who should build the well thinks he shall have to dig 40 feet, and the baker doubts he shall never like to drive up to the door. And the practical neighbor cavils at the position of the barn, and the citizen comes to know what his predecessor, the farmer, built the house in the right spot for the sun and wind, the spring and water drainage, and the convenience to the pasture, the garden, the field, and the road. So Dock Square yields the point, and things have their own way. Use has made the farmer wise, and the foolish citizen learns to take his counsel. From step to step he comes to the last to surrender at discretion. The farmer affects to take his orders, but the citizen says, "You may ask me as often as you will, and in what ingenious form, for an opinion concerning the mode of building my wall, or sinking my well, or laying out my acre, but the ball will rebound to you. These are matters on which I neither know nor need to know anything. These are questions which you and not I shall answer." Not less with doors, a system settles itself paramount and tyrannical over master and mistress, servant and child, cousin and an acquaintance. 'Tis in vain this genius or virtue or energy or character strive and cry against it. This is fate, and this very well that the poor husband reads in a book of a new way of living and resolves to adopt it at home. Let him go home and try it, if he dare. Another point of economy is to look for seed of the same kind as you sow, and not to hope to buy one kind with another kind. Friendship buys friendship, justice, justice, military merit, merit, military success. Good husbandry finds wife, children, and household. The good merchant, large gains, ships, stocks, and money. The good poet, fame, and literary credit, but not either the other. Yet there is commonly a confusion of expectations on these points. A hot spur lives for the moment, praises himself for it, and despises Furlong, and he does not. Hotspur, of course, is poor, and Furlong is a good provider. The odd circumstance is that Hotspur thinks it is a superiority in himself, this improvidence, which ought to be rewarded with Furlong's lands. I have not at all completed my design, but we must not leave the topic without casting one glance into the interior recesses. It is a doctrine of philosophy that man is a being of degrees, and there is nothing in the world which is not repeated in his body, this body being a sort of miniature or a summary of the world. Then that there is nothing in his body which is not repeated, and in a celestial sphere in his mind. Then there is nothing in his brain which is not repeated in a higher sphere in his moral system. Now these things are not so in nature. All things ascend, and the rule And the royal rule of economy is that it should ascend also, or whatever we do must always have a higher aim. Thus it is a maxim that money is another kind of blood, pecunia alter sanguis, or the estate of a man is only a larger kind of body, and admits of regimen analogous to his bodily circulation. So there is no maximum of merchant. Best use of money is to pay debts. Every business by itself. Best time is present time. The right investment is in tools of your trade, or the like which does not admit of an extended sense. The counting room maxims liberally expounds the laws of the universe. The merchant economy is a coarse symbol of the soul's economy. It is to spend for power and not for pleasure. It is to invest income, that is to say, to take up particulars into generals, days into integral eras, and literary, emotive, practical of its life, and still to ascend in its investment. The merchant has but one rule: absorb and invest. He is to be capitalist. The scraps and filings must be gathered back into the crucible. The gas and smoke must be burned. The earnings must not go to increase expense, but to capital again. Well, the man must be capitalist. Will he spend his income, or will he invest? His body and every organ is under the same law. His body is a jar in which the liquor of life is stored. Will he spend for pleasure? The way to ruin is short and facile. Will he not spend, but hoard for power? It passes through the sacred fermentations by the law of nature, whereby everything climbs to the higher platforms, and bodily vigor becomes mental and moral vigor. The bread he eats is for strength and animal spirits. It becomes in higher laboratories imaginary in thought, and in still higher results courage and endurance. This is the right compound interest, that is, capital doubled, quadrupled, centupled, man raised to his highest power. The true thrift is always to spend on the higher plane, to invest in keener avarice, that which may spend in spiritual creation and not in augmenting animal existence. Nor is the man enriched by repeating the old experiments of animal sensation, nor, unless through new powers and ascending pleasures, he knows himself by the actual experience of higher good to be already on the way to the highest. And that ends the essay on wealth by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I hope you enjoyed that. it was a little long, but definitely worth listening to, for sure. It was a great, great essay. And as with all of Emerson's work, there's no question of his genius and his touch with the oneness of the universe. A man who understood the cosmic laws and understood where his place was in the world. And with that, I want to thank everybody, and I wish you a prosperous new year.